This week on the show, iPhone comes to Verizon, a tablet overload at CES, and Courtney Love's tweets head to court. All this and more on This Week in Media, number 218. Hello and welcome to This Week in Media. This is Lon Seidman with LocalOnlineNews.tv. Got some great guests with us today with some great topics. The first right here in Connecticut, who's only 20 minutes up the road from me, but we actually never do the show together, is Steve Lettieri from Killer Minnow. How are things going, Steve? What are you up to these days?
Hey, Lon. Doing well. We're gearing up to move into the iOS game space. That's sort of our big 2011 initiative, but you know, still doing the visual effects, animation, and design stuff for our wonderful clients like Hasbro and the like.
Excellent. And there's a lot of money in those iPhone games, I hear. So with a big announcement from Verizon today, I think your market might have grown.
So yes, we'll
talk about that
exciting.
In a minute. We'll talk about that in a minute. And joining us also at the very last minute, in fact, we just sent him the show notes like 25 seconds ago, so he's going to sound really smart, because he's a brilliant guy, and that is Zach Louie. Zach, how you doing? So what are you up to these days?
Right now, I just got back from Atlanta, Georgia, doing some client work down there. And we, I'm going to be honest with you, most of our time was spent playing football in the hotel lobby or with various various valet people at different hotels that we were shooting at. But I managed to sneak away from the catering green room with about 70 gallons of San Pellegrino and Perrier. So right now I'm enjoying Monster and Pellegrino, so that's what I'm up to.
You're well hydrated.
Oh, it's so bubbly and amazing.
That's terrific. Well, we've got tons of stuff to cover. I want to start first with the announcement that just came today with the Verizon iPhone. Clearly, and Steve, love to hear your thoughts on this, because that's a market-opening opportunity for you. So many people that I know have shifted over to Android phones because they just couldn't wait any longer to get their hands on a functional smartphone. So, Steve, what's your take on Verizon now expanding the iPhone market significantly?
Well, I think as a consumer, you're always happy to have a choice. You know, that certainly makes things more competitive in the marketplace. So I think overall it's great. I certainly know my partner, Rob, who is a Verizon customer and is a Palm Pre user, which he's not in love with. So he's been waiting very patiently and has actually been sort of skipping around the office this morning with this news. So he's very excited. And yeah, I think it's a good thing for everybody. And obviously, Apple is probably going to be the big winner in all this.
More money in Steve Jobs' pocket, that's for sure. Zach, what do you use for a phone? What's your weapon of choice?
My weapon of choice, my sidearm, would be the iPhone 4, and it's currently shattered. And it's still in one piece, but it's shattered. I'll tell you what, it's more of a conversation piece than anything, because people often ask me, they're like, "Hey, your phone's broken. Why are you doing this with your life?" And I tell them, "Listen, first off, my phone's not a piece of jewelry. It's a functional tool that I use. Second off, hey, you just talked to me about my phone, so that's a pretty nice conversation piece."
It is a nice conversation piece, that's for sure. And you know, it makes you wonder why make a phone that's made out of glass on both sides?
Because it looks baller chill. That's
it
why
it does. It absolutely does. And so now, because I'm on an iPhone 4 also. I'm on AT&T. I see, you know, initially when I had the first iPhone, the coverage was horrible. It's gotten somewhat better here in Connecticut. I know our listeners in major metropolitan areas will certainly have other opinions of it. But from your perspective, Zach, you know, you're a traveler. You're a man of international flair. Are you going to switch to the Verizon phone, or is the AT&T phone working for you?
Absolutely not going to switch over. First off, let me just say the plans, the data rate, everything I assume is going to be the same price. Verizon has a higher barrier of exit, I like to call it. They have a higher cancellation rate on the contracts. The minimum contract is 2 years, just like AT&T. They're going to offer an unlimited plan, I expect, for probably $30 a month. And even then, there's talks of them pulling it and throwing down a data cap for that phone anyway. So I won't be switching over, because essentially it's the same product. They have the same price as far as Verizon and AT&T goes for talking and texting. The data is going to be the same price. I'm already grandfathered into the unlimited plan with AT&T, so that's fine. Verizon doesn't have rollover, and rollovers saved me a few times because sometimes I talk to people that aren't on AT&T, and which seems to be a problem. So what I'm hoping for at this moment is when the bulk of new users rush over to Verizon and change their plans, or the people that would normally be signing up for the iPhone and the people that would normally force AT&T to sort of reinforce their infrastructure as far as media support goes. My hope is that it's going to move over a million, thousand, trillion people to Verizon's data service, and it's going to pull a load off of AT&T's, and it's going to allow us to surf a lot easier without much of a constricted bandwidth. You see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
we're gonna get. We'll think of it like market share. They're gonna move over. We're gonna get a slightly larger market share because everyone's making the switch. So, as far as pricing goes, it's not going to be different. And the whole the CDMA issue with the Verizon iPhone really kind of annoys me. The fact that there's no talk and data at the same time. So every time you receive a call, your data connection will break. So
right.
no internet or surfing or the video, any of that stuff while talking on the phone. So I know a lot of people don't do that, but I do it, and I know a lot of people that do. So for me, that's a deal breaker all on its own.
And for me too, and certainly for app creators too, it could be an issue if there are some social apps that have some phone calling aspect to it. But definitely, you know, from the standpoint of competitiveness, I thought Apple was giving up a tremendous amount of market share by not being on Verizon sooner, and I think there's some people they've lost to Android perhaps forever, but nonetheless they are there now. And anyone listening who's writing apps, your market has improved. So we'll see what that means for developers and for content creators. It's pretty exciting stuff.
It's almost a little disappointing because I know that a lot of the. I mean, I'm just going to throw out a number here, but let's just say half of the people switching over to Android aren't doing it because it's Android. They're doing it because it's a touchscreen smartphone and they just can't have the iPhone. So
right.
What's going to happen now? The availability of the iPhone is going to be, you know, on Verizon, the world's largest or the nation's largest mobile carrier, that essentially we're going to have so many less people jumping on bandwagon for the Android, and it's just going to, you know, kill their market share. And my buddy Michael was IMing me earlier, and he said it's just going to cannibalize the Android marketplace because people are going to be developing kind of solely focusing their efforts on, you know, what device has the largest market share.
Exactly, and it raises the bar. One last point on Verizon before we move on is that this deal is not exclusive. So we could very well see the iPhone CDMA come to Sprint, and who knows if T-Mobile and other carriers in the U.S. might also pick up on it soon. So this is a big day for Apple, big day for content creation, and I think you know we'll see where things go from here. But we've got two great phones phone platforms now on multiple carriers, which is always good for us. And hopefully standards will remain to some degree, so we're not spending too much money trying to figure out how to get our stuff to the people that want to see it. So
yeah. It'll be interesting, just to follow up on something Zach said about, you know, if Verizon has a more egregious sort of cancellation policy, you wonder how many people will be jumping, and if they can, you know, if they're sort of locked into a contract, you know, for another year or so. You wonder what the real numbers are going to be for people moving over.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be interesting to see who does that. And actually, Verizon's giving first dibs to people that are already existing Verizon customers. So they're almost not even seeking out the AT&T folks yet, but I'm sure they will follow perhaps, and others might stay where they are. So we'll have to keep track on that. So now let's talk about CES. All of us, to one degree or another, produce video. And now you guys are using some pro-level gear. I'm running a scrappy little news startup, and we're always going with the consumer stuff. But let me start with Zach. Is there anything at CES that really caught your eye as something you might use as a tool for content creation professionally?
Yes, a few of my buddies at TechCrunch and really Tim Street who hopped on board and sent me the DM this morning, like, hey, will you take my place on the show? just been teasing the Red Scarlet at me, and as a, you know, as a filmmaker, as a whatever, videographer, football quarterback extraordinaire, I'm extremely, extremely excited about, you know, the ability to have 3K video, you know, 3K filmic look within the palm of my hand for under $10,000. So that's pretty awesome.
And is there a release date yet, or is that still out up in the air?
The Red Scarlet has been tentative to release for literally 6 years now, and that's not a hyperbolized statement. Like literally 6 years now. So I have no idea.
Right.
I don't think anyone knows. But they are holding. I have seen prototype units. Tim's held one last year.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is any window of logic for you, look at this. Riddle me this. Last year at this time, Tim was holding the Red Scarlet, and he was like, "Oh, dude, it's a Red Scarlet. It's gonna be awesome." I'm like, "Yeah, Tim, that's really cool. It's a Red Scarlet." He's like, yeah, it's really cool. Year later, people are still just holding it. If you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So
yeah, it's like the it's become the Duke Nukem of
Duke Nukem
video.
Right.
Here,
that's actually the best reference I've ever heard. Congrats on that one.
Yeah, it's that would probably be one of the products that I would bring up as well as catching the eye of folks like us. Overall, I was sort of disappointed, I think, in what was happening at CES this year. I'm not a huge 3D fan. So, there seemed to be, a lot of that still coming out from the TV manufacturers. And obviously the camcorder folks are starting to come out with consumer 3D cameras. And so that doesn't necessarily get me excited. And then all these, other tablets other than the iPad, I guess once you play with an iPad, it's hard to get too excited about anybody else.
It's a lot of saturation too in the marketplace with all of these devices. There's so much 3D, so much tablet. The one thing that I took away from it was the Canon booth. And Canon now has a consumer grade, I love consumer grade cameras for what we do. And they have a consumer grade camera now that has XLR inputs, which we've been kind of jury rigging along on our current gear. So that was kind of an exciting thing to see there. And I do think, we talk a lot about 3D on the show. And last week, Alex was talking about the Fujifilm W3. He got me so interested, I actually went out and bought one. Alex Lindsay is the worst influence on my credit card ever. And in fact,
Lindsay is a bad man.
He's a very bad man, especially I blame when my wife asked what the heck was this, I blamed it on Alex. But Alex was actually at CES. He did a whole series of very short videos with his iPhone, and they're terrific. They're on YouTube. We'll put a link up to that on the This Week in Media Facebook page. So check those out. And he did a great series of very quick things of the things that he found interesting there. But I got this W3 camera. It's a great camera. It's really cool. It's got a 3D screen on the back. You don't need glasses for it. It's still among the best out there for taking stills and video. The problem is that people's vector for working on video and photos is going into the computer, and there really isn't a way to view the 3D on the computer without the blue-red glasses. And there's not an easy thing for a consumer to do. I mean, I'm able to get some output from it, but it's definitely not there yet. So I'd be interested to see, as these products make it to market, what kind of tools there might be on the computer end to look at those areas. But I too was kind of disappointed with CES. There's just so much stuff, very hard to comprehend it all. And once again, Apple kind of loomed large with the rumors of impending Verizon doom for anyone who was trying to compete there. But according to the Wall Street Journal, the number of attendees has risen, as have the exhibits. So there seems to be a lot of action happening there. And it looks like the consumer electronics industry is growing substantially, and advertisers are taking notice of that as well. One thing that did come up there, according to the Washington Post, was that the FCC chairman is vowed to seek more spectrum for mobile broadband. So Julius Genachowski, who's the chairman of the FCC, is really running a pretty active campaign here on not only net neutrality, but also providing more bandwidth. And he did warn that without reclaiming more airwaves for mobile broadband, consumers are going to be facing slower smartphone and tablet connections, and that the actual economy could suffer as a result. So it looks like we're going to have to get some more spectrum available. The FCC is going to release about 500 megahertz, the 500 megahertz band for mobile broadband, and they've been kind of auctioning that off piecemeal, and they have to recover that from other places. But let me ask you guys this. We've talked a little bit about net neutrality and the carve out for mobile there. Steve, developing wireless apps, how much bandwidth are your games going to use? Are you concerned about these issues that AT&T kind of exemplified in the recent problems that many people have had?
Yeah, we haven't yet put anything out, so we haven't had to deal with that. But I have been, sort of reading up on it, and I know some developers that we talk to, talk about, trying to get their apps to a certain size so that they can do it over the data networks and not have to rely on Wi-Fi or whatnot. So, yeah, I think it's not an area that I know a lot about, but it seems like anything that will help us consumers have access to content is going to be something I'll be in support of.
And Zach, the people that you make videos for, mobile is on everyone's mind. bandwidth on 3G for viewing video is often pretty crappy. what do you think about this? I mean, what's the barrier for some of your clients in getting their content viewed when people are not near a Wi-Fi hotspot?
Well, my target market currently rests in the sandy shores of Antarctica, so they have to get their video content mailed to them via solid state hard drive.
Okay.
I would have been worried about this 2 years ago, 3 years ago, but I mean, with how technology has risen, you know, I'm honestly not too concerned about the constraints because people just need to sit back and realize, hey, that the signal's coming from space. Like, give it a second.
Right. So there is some excuse, people excuse some of the bandwidth hiccups right now.
That needs to be like an intro drop in.
Right.
At the very beginning of every video, actually.
Right. By the way, you're on 3G. Be patient with us. Right.
It's the miracle of data on your phone. Relax.
Yes, exactly. Right. You couldn't do this even 5 years ago. So let's just get over it. Well, one thing that came out of CES last week, according to Engadget, is that Panasonic and Verizon are teaming up for mobile high-definition visual communication systems using LTE, which is the next generation of wireless technology that both AT&T and Verizon will be using in the coming years. One of the interesting things about the Verizon announcement today was that LTE was not part of the iPhone 4 on Verizon, so it will be using the 3G network, but surely LTE will come in the future, and it's providing a considerable amount of bandwidth there. So what do you think the adoption rate on this is going to be? I mean, it's going to take some time for these devices to get out there. I know that there are some Android LTE devices, but Zach, you know, just back to our last question about the disclaimer, if LTE is that much faster, and I had some Verizon people trying to pitch me on some of their LTE products the other day, what does that mean for segmenting content between 3G people and 4G people?
I don't think that the content will be differentiated. I think that maybe the quality, as far as the encode ratio of like the kilobytes per second on what the video is actually encoded at, might change some for different speeds of users. You can absolutely upload a higher resolution file if they're cranking LTE video chatting via Skype from their cars.
right.
Just looking at the show notes here, though, I mean that's pretty awesome. I can't think of anything I'd like to do more than video chatting from the highway, actually.
You know, I tried that the other day, and I should add that in my car.
Let me add
the disclaimer here. So, I have in my car one of these vent mounts, right? So you attach this thing to your vent, and the phone's pointed at me. Now, of course, I have an iPhone, so I can't actually video chat from 3G unless I'm on Wi-Fi.
I
jailbreak my old phone, but not my... I'm going to go to jail after talking on this show. I jailbreak my old phone, but not my new phone, just because I don't want to break it. But one thing I did do was pop on my Verizon MiFi and actually called my wife while I was driving. I wasn't looking at her when I was driving.
She was looking at you,
she
though.
She was looking at me, though. And but it was kind of cool that you could do something like that. And I'm driving in my car thinking, wow, this is like the future. I'm in my car talking on a video phone. It's kind of a neat thing.
Yeah, so, no. The next step is building a small eyesight into the rearview mirror. That's
right,
where it's
right. Exactly. Then you can keep an eye on your teenagers wherever they are. And that's the kind of
true. Wow.
You know, right? You can keep an eye on your kids as to, you know, what they're doing in the car. You can, you know, slap these little cameras anywhere you want. I mean, it's going to change a lot when we have a reliable network that is accessible. And it might even lend itself to some really new and innovative content creation ideas, too.
Absolutely. Now we're getting there. It's just going to take a bit for the infrastructure.
Yeah, I've been interested. One thing that did kind of catch my eye at CES was some of these the car companies with their new integrated entertainment systems that are doing a lot, you know, pulling in apps and things, you know, which you start to wonder, like, who's actually using these, like you said, while you're driving, you know, Twittering and Facebooking and using Pandora and all these things. Obviously, you know, Pandora makes sense, but you know, I guess it's more for the folks in your car, not you as a driver, but
we'll call them passengers.
That's the word I was looking for. Thank you. So, it's pretty cool. You know, I don't know if we truly need HD in our cars for this kind of thing, but, you know, hey, if it's pushing the envelope a little bit,
why not let it go? And now with all this 4G hotness, we need some kind of devices to ride the highway. And of course, tablets, next to 3D were huge at CES. Andy Anacco from the Sun-Times found that not all tablets, of course, are created equal. And he had a pretty interesting little article that you can find on the Sun-Times.com talking about all the varying excuses some of the manufacturers had for not actually having finished product on for display and other things. But BlackBerry's got a tablet. We have Android tablets that are running the Google quote-unquote experience that pay Google the licensing fee. We've got other knockoffs from China that are running the open source version of Android. There's probably half a dozen other people that are going to try tablets as well, including Vizio, the television maker. Content guys, Steve especially, you're making video that's going out on the web. You're making apps for the iPhone. Presumably, you'll probably go to the iPad as well. How do you keep up with this? If you're going to program for one platform, which do you choose? How do you get your content where eyeballs are looking? And at some point, do you just decide that the audience on this device isn't large enough for me to waste my time? So what's your take on all this very unsettled tablet market at the moment?
Well, you know, I think initially you always say, you know, competition is good and anything that pushes innovation is helpful for the consumer. But it's a challenge as a creator if you're trying to figure out the platforms you're going to use. We're going to focus on the, you know, iOS initially for the games that we're developing, so iPhone, iPad. But, you know, Android is definitely in sort of the back of our mind for this. And, you know, we'll certainly be keeping an eye on the growth of the market for Android, you know, especially in light of the Verizon announcement today. But it's tough to sort of shuffle through all these different devices. And it gets interesting when you start seeing how they're talking about adding, you know, keyboards and whatnot. And you know, you start to scratch your head a little bit and say, well, you know, isn't that just a laptop, you know?
Right. It's exactly. Right, or is it some other kind of the thing there? And let me ask you from the development point of view, clearly the Apple development process is different than the Android process. I'm sure it will be different than the BlackBerry process. How do your people keep up with that? Are you hiring developers on a freelance basis that have experience in these areas, or are you trying to have your in-house programmer try to learn everything? What's your process?
We're focused on the creative side of things here, so we rely on our partners to help us with the technical end of things. So, you know, we sort of let them sort through all those, you know, the various requirements and whatnot for the different platforms. You know, like I said, you know, for us, it's just kind of keep a focus initially on iOS and see what happens after that.
Right, and see how the market shakes out. So clearly, in your view, from the standpoint of where to put your money down, Android for a tablet isn't there yet. So we're going to stick to iOS and see where it goes to. Zach, are you a tablet owner?
Am I a tablet owner? Yes, I've got an iPad sitting in front of me.
And do you see any reason to switch from that to another platform, or will you look at getting an Android platform to even see what it's like? Nothing. It's solved all your problems.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
Take a moment to think. So.
Yeah, let me mull it over for a bit over some nice cider. No, I use mine for reading. It's more candy than anything. You know, it's not incredibly functional. I see it as a cookbook around the house. Want to watch something, you know, and it's simple and it's got a great battery life. I think that's probably the winning factor of most of these tablets, is because they've been able to use, you know, the Atom processor and have lower battery consumption, which has been excellent. So now the new MacBooks are, you know, pushing 12-hour lithium batteries that don't have the ghosting effect, and, you know, the last four times as long as recent technology. So I'm kind of scratching my head like you were, Steve. Like, I'm thinking like, it's cool. And, you know, I use mine for a book and I use it for reading RSS feeds. But other than that, I mean, it's not incredibly functional. That's just my complete and honest opinion. And, you know, I wasn't a fan of the iPad when it came out. And then I bought it about 4 days after it came out and fell in love with it. And I still use it and I like it. But at the end of the day, like you guys were saying, the market is just getting incredibly saturated. And I think that CES pushing... It's just ridiculous. I'm reading through here and I'm seeing different prices, different screen sizes, you know, pushing the Android OS, pushing blah, 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 blah. It's like, come on.
And it's hard to develop when you've got three different screen sizes. It's tough enough now with even on the iPhone side to have things that are fit for the, ready for the Retina display and not and developing the universal.
It's like, how am I supposed to get this leather case and not move it up? This thing's supposed to age with me. Come on now.
Right. It's the standardization again. It's difficult to keep up on all this stuff, especially when your funds are limited. And I think in Steve's case, it's a great example of you got to choose a platform to launch on and Apple has it right now as far as that stuff is concerned. And Android is going to be there too, but right now, that's where he's putting his money down. So
at the end of the day, it's almost counterproductive. It's almost like getting distracted by candy over functionality. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, well, hey, you know what? There's an active marketplace. A lot of people are trying, and we'll see where it goes. So we're going to veer off from some CES stuff and actually talk a little bit about content. And this is some expensive content that was supposed to show up on, I believe, the History Channel, which was the Kennedys, a controversial miniseries. Apparently, it's been produced, and A&E Networks has decided not to air that miniseries because they felt it wasn't historically accurate. What was of interest to me, beyond all the political implications of what's going on here, is the fact that it will be airing in other countries. It'll be airing in Canada and will be available internationally, just not available here in the United States just yet, although there's some rumors that Showtime or another network might end up picking it up. But you know what struck me about this was the fact that we've seen this with some other shows as well. Battlestar Galactica, as an example, ended the spinoff, Caprica, ended its run on the Sci-Fi Network. And the episodes, the last episodes, actually continued to air in Canada, but the United States portion of that of the Sci-Fi universe held on to that and to run them as a week-long or a day-long marathon. But is this raised the piracy stakes? I mean, is this preventing people from watching it who might be paying customers, per se? What are the implications of some of this international stuff? Let me start with Zach on that.
I think that we're probably looking at, like you said, they're going to be pushing internationally, but I think that as far as piracy goes, you know, let's talk about the normal market that would be pirating it anyway, whether or not it got accepted to the network or not, because that market's there, a given, so we'll just push that off to the side. So the people that normally would be pirating this content will probably end up still pirating it because it's going to be readily available. The people that would normally stumble upon it on the History Channel will probably not care. The people who have heard about it on the web, such as this, are going to be kind of in my shoes, where I'm hoping that a place like Showtime or AMC picks this up. It seems like more of a fit for a network like Showtime or AMC. Anyway, Joel Cerno co-created 24, and I think that if Joel would have casted Kiefer Sutherland instead of Greg Kinnear as the lead, I think that we'd be seeing a much different story right now. No, but you know what I'm saying, guys? Like, does this really seem like an incredible History Channel 50? We've got Greg Kinnear playing John F. Kennedy. We've got Katie Holmes playing Jackie Onassis.
Right.
This is a little too highbrow scripted. You know, high budget, big casted, written well. I mean, not to say that History Channel has low level content, but it's just, this is probably why they didn't accept it. It's kind of breaking the mold of what they do, and they seem to be a kind of a conservative network.
Yeah, well, they seem to be much more interested in the sort of the reality type shows nowadays. You know, they talk about like, you know, history happening every day or whatever it is. But it seems like there's a little more to this story than we're hearing. You know, you can't imagine that History or A&E, you know, networks was not fully aware of what was being created here. And suddenly at the final hour, they realized, oops, you know, something's wrong with this content in some way for them. So you wonder what the real story is. But you know, based on the cast and the quality of the folks involved, you got to imagine somebody's going to pick this up for distribution in the U.S.
Right. It seems like a little I kind of find it hard to believe that this was created specifically for the History Channel. I mean, this has got Katie Holmes and Greg Kinnear. Like, I'm just kind of like, I don't know. Like you said, there's probably something that we're not being told.
And it could just be too that, you know, you have these cable networks which are incredibly niche, and even though the History Channel something is as popular as it is, the audience is not huge as compared to network TV standards perhaps, or other cable networks. And you know, there could be some risk involved in upsetting portions of their audience, and maybe they did some analysis to determine that there could be a risk to airing that. What was interesting was that there were no objections from advertisers. It was actually something the network kind of did on their own up front. But clearly now this is a news story. It'll probably make the rounds throughout the blogosphere, and I'm sure the desire to see it might increase. In fact, I hadn't even heard of this until it showed up on our show notes.
Right.
So I don't think we've seen the last of it. Zach and Steve, too, direct to DVD. We've seen a few shows get canceled. All the shows that I like on TV tend to get canceled after the first season. So either I have like really bad taste, or I'm just not like most people. But I would gladly pay to just see a direct to DVD or direct to download thing of my favorite shows. I think there's a market for that. There's been some limited success in some areas. What do you guys think about that? We'll start with Zach.
First off, I'd be glad if you paid for it for me as well.
Okay, sure.
I think that we're ignoring the obvious issue here is that it could have been an unfortunate game of rock, paper, scissors gone awry, which could have forced us out of the escape. But no, but seriously, I think that you're exactly right. I think that with it already being finished, for one, like the quality of the programming, I think that, you know, if another network doesn't pick it up, I don't know the dotted line. I don't know the fine print on their contract that they have for the development process. But I think that a direct to DVD could be profitable. We know that it's still kind of a romanticized history timeline, and it really wasn't that long ago. Crazily enough, like, you know, this is just last century, you know, a handful of years ago. So I think that a lot of the baby boomers would be very apt to pick up this DVD series, because they're honestly still buying a lot of DVDs. So
right, it makes a great gift. It's a lot nicer to gift something physical and tangible than a iTunes gift card per se. So
now the Mac App Store. Don't get me started. That's next week.
That's next week. Exactly. We'll talk about that later. So let's talk about WikiLeaks again for a minute, because it certainly impacts some things. And actually, it's been a very intriguing story developing here. And Salon.com reports that I'm going to attempt to pronounce this gentleman's name, and I'm probably going to screw it up. Birgitta Jonsdottir. He's a former WikiLeaks volunteer and actually a member of the Icelandic parliament. He announced on Twitter that Twitter notified him. So
I believe that's a woman, Lon.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. She. thank you for the correction. So I need to become more worldly here. So, but nonetheless, she was notified. If I read my copy here, I would have corrected that myself. had been notified by Twitter that the Department of Justice had served a subpoena demanding information about all of her tweets and more since November 1st, 2009. And what was interesting about this is that Twitter's policy, and apparently had been in place before this happened, is to notify users when they do receive a subpoena request. This is something that other online services don't do. And that gives the respondent some time to get representation before that information is released. And now there's a lot of talk about how this should be the policy across the board from other sites, other online services that get subpoenaed from time to time, including Google and Facebook, who often get orders and then quickly comply, sometimes not letting the subject know that they are being investigated. Zach, do you have anything to hide? And what do you think about Twitter's policy here?
I absolutely have something to hide. Unfortunately, I would not be broadcasting that on Twitter. So, as much as I would like to have some witty subtext for this, this is completely unrelated to anything that I do or care about. Although I think that Birgitta Jonsdottir, may be the singer of Sigur Rós. So,
okay, well, there you go.
in terms of Twitter's policy, I think it's great that they're sort of. I've seen some people describe them, you know, that their policy has a spine to it, which is helpful for all of us that are using these types of services. I think Google may have a similar policy where they don't necessarily immediately comply with requests for information, and they do notify their users that are ahead of time before they turn anything over. So, yeah, clearly there's you know, or it seems to be that there's some retribution activities going on here on the part of the Department of Justice, and this is just a big messy story that seems to reveal new layers every day.
It almost seems like the WikiLeaks issue is almost inevitable, and it could have been WikiLeaks, or it could have been some other organization. It just shows just how this network has become so embedded that it is almost impossible now to control it. And what really struck me in all of this is that there needs to be a lot of behavioral change on the part of people who have information that needs to be protected. And in the case of the WikiLeaks scenario, some unprotected data was accessible to someone who, you know, as far as the United States law is concerned, is a traitor to their country. He took information that was partially classified, even though it was available on the network he had access to. And that person then leaked it to WikiLeaks, and off it went. And despite so many efforts to try to shut down the organization, they keep popping back up in different places. And it is really striking to me just how much this entire issue is having us look at how media interacts in society, what is journalism, and how do you work with information that comes into the public space as it has with WikiLeaks, and they're clearly not done yet. Julian Assange is dealing with a whole host of unrelated legal issues right now, but you know, his organization is still out there, and other organizations are popping up. So it's just a fascinating story, and I think really shows just how quickly the internet has changed society, and for content creators especially, how easy it is for us to give out information that we want people to see for free. The other side of it is the fact that it becomes a lot more difficult to protect the things that you don't want people to see, because bits are very easy to copy. So we'll have to keep an eye on this, and especially just how some of these people will be handled by the Department of Justice and Twitter, who will be notifying users. Apparently, many more people have received similar notifications from Twitter. So we'll have to follow this.
Thing I was wondering is, with Twitter, I haven't really investigated it, but you know, since it's sort of a public, you know, system, wouldn't you know this woman's Twitter stream, you know, be archived somewhere where you wouldn't need a subpoena to go
right.
get it? You know,
well, I'm sure that there's actually a pretty large archive somewhere in the U.S. government where the Twitter fire hose is going into every day, but perhaps things like private messages that, you know, the direct messages that go in between people, my 17th inbox that I have to check every day, and other things related to that. So I could see how there might be some private information, perhaps private Twitter lists that person subscribes to, and a whole host of other things that the Department of Justice is using to try to build their case. And I would assume this is to build the case against Private Manning, who leaked all this information to WikiLeaks in the first place. And how he did it was really just striking to me, that somebody could walk into a secure government facility as a private in the Army and just have ready available access to all of this data. So it's
you know, he walked in there feeling like a total baller.
Exactly. And
he was strutting his way in there. He said, "Listen, give me them files."
And he just burn them. And he did. He
armed with a thumb drive.
Yeah, with a thumb drive. It was camouflage.
No, actually, he was armed with a rewritable CD-ROM.
I didn't know they still made CD-RWs. That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I have a bunch sitting on the shelf that I haven't touched in probably 8 years, I guess. But he literally walked in with a disc labeled Lady Gaga and just I kid you not. And he said that he was pretending like he was listening to music while he was.
They couldn't read his poker face. They couldn't read it. Anyway.
And it's just, and I think from, you know, the standpoint of everyone who has information, company, you know, even people listening who have companies, you know, there's proprietary company information that you don't want to get out there. You really need to look at your data security also, because once it does leave the protection of your local area network, it's out there. And, you know, not all of us are doing things that might have secrets as attractive as to the general public as something like WikiLeaks or perhaps Paris Hilton's email. But there are things that you need to be very careful about, and securing your data is a really critical thing. But speaking of Twitter, Courtney Love had her Twitter account suspended. I don't know if you guys are following this saga, but she's being sued, according to DigitalSpy.com, by, I'm going to mispronounce another name, Dawn Simeranker, over alleged derogatory comments that Courtney Love allegedly made about her on the microblogging site back in 2009. According to The Hollywood Reporter, Courtney Love's Twitter account, called Courtney Love UK, has now been pulled from the site temporarily as the defamation case moves forward. And we've talked a little bit about this before, and I think it's an important topic worth bringing up again, because it is easy to defame others without even knowing it, or without knowing that you are committing a crime or putting yourself into that kind of liability, especially for content creators, and especially people that are reporting news like I am, to be protected against that sort of thing. Zach, do you often think about that when, let's say, if we're out there tweeting about how lousy a particular airline might be or something? I mean, are you thinking about the implications of your liability?
Yeah, absolutely. I I've always practiced the art of not being stupid online, saying stuff that I shouldn't, you know, dissing a certain thing.
Right.
I just think that I try to live by the age old mantra, you know, if you've got nothing nice to say, don't say it at all. You know
right.
what I'm saying?
Yep.
That sounds really cheesy, but it's so true. It'll keep you out of trouble and it'll also make you not look like a complaining, like, I don't know how to say this without using profanity, so I'm trying to rephrase myself. It'll make you look less annoying because no one likes someone that complains. You know what I mean? You just look annoying, then, and no one wants to be annoying.
And Steve, let me ask you, because I don't know if you're doing content beyond entertainment and things related to that, but clearly there's all kinds of liability you can get yourself into, even in the course of a fictional story. And we're at a place now where, you know, one person can potentially do the damage that some of these big libel and slander suits that happened during the 80s with the National Enquirer and other tabloid magazines. You know, one person can now have that reach. So, Steve, are you thinking about that when you're producing scripts and other things? I mean, is there the potential of perhaps a video that goes viral that makes fun of a certain person that they claim damages them?
I've actually got something to plug, which is really funny.
Oh, good.
Last December, I produced Adagio TV. So last December, I guess November, we were issued a lawsuit from Celestial Seasonings, a rival tea company that is very large and widespread, but within regular markets like Walmart or things like that, it's a really low grade tea, but it's in a lot of chain stores, and they're constantly trolling our database, you know, just getting their creep on. And as you know, Adagio, we offer signature blends for customers to go on the website and to make their own blends and have their own name, and we mail them, you know. So some woman in her late middle-aged woman named a tea, I forget the exact name, it was something like Martha's Zinger or something like that, you know. It was for her, she's just gonna have in her pantry. And Special Seasonings got their troll on, and they found the word Zinger on one of our teas. And so they issued us this massive lawsuit saying, listen, you got to take that off because that's not cool. Also, we're going to sue you for money. And it was like some lady bought this. So as a rebuttal, we laughed and we wrote a script called Adagio TV Repo Edition. And it was an entire script where we held up the actual legal papers from Celestial Seasoning.
Nice.
So, yeah, it was pretty funny, and our customer base loved it, and it went semi-viral in the community. So job well done. That's what I think about. That's what I think about trouble. We just parody it and make fun of it, and then they go back in their little holes
and come back and come back swinging. Steve, what are your considerations when you have things like that? Because there's a great example of something that you're not even thinking about that could result in a liability.
Yeah, we haven't produced anything where we've had to really keep that in mind. But you know, libel is a pretty tough thing to prove, especially if you're starting to deal with celebrities. I think you have to have this intent piece that to do harm. And I'm not sure if this person that Courtney Love is accused of defaming is a celebrity or not. I don't recognize her name, but you have to prove that whatever was said was false. You have to prove that you were that it caused harm, so that's probably one of the harder pieces of it all. But yeah, no, it's not anything that we've had to deal with. I think what Zach said about let's just all try to be nice and get along here, and if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it.
Right. Can't we all just get along?
Can't we all just love one another?
I will share with the viewers, and I talked about this probably a couple of months ago, and it's always important to remind people about this as well. My news operation here, localonlinenews.tv, we cover local news, and generally you can cover local news in a way that you don't perhaps rise into the level of slander or libel, but you never know. And even if you are clear, and Steve, you're absolutely right, that the threshold for actually proving damages in a slander or libel case is very difficult to cross, but the cost of defending yourself is often a consideration. And a lot of times these cases settle because of the tremendous cost of defending them. And one thing that we did is we went out and bought a policy, an insurance policy, to protect ourselves in case we ever have one of those situations. Because we haven't done any real heavy duty investigative pieces yet, but there have been things that we've reported on that were of interest to the community that impacted one party against another, kind of thing, political, perhaps some planning and zoning issues, those sorts of things that people have a lot of money invested in these local projects. And if for some reason the reporter misinterpreted something, and you just have a tremendous amount of liability, and that's something for people to consider. And the other thing is to also think about just physical physical liability, that if you have an employee or even a contractor who's out on the road and causes an accident or some other kind of thing, your fledgling media business could quickly find itself in some severe legal trouble. So if you haven't bought a policy, not to depress everyone at the end of the show here, if you haven't bought a policy, you really should contact a qualified insurance agent and just look at what your options are. Because the last thing you want to do in a startup is get sued so badly that you have to shut down and perhaps even
LLC.
That's right. Right. So, but that about does it for today's show. And I want to thank both of you, especially Zach, for coming on at such a late moment. Always an entertaining guest with plenty of
information to share. I feel bad to interrupt you, but I want you to know that don't feel bad because I was transferring 140 gigs from an iMac to an external, so we are good.
All right, so that's like the little hourglass, right?
This has been like they literally just put it on my desk and plugged it in and gave me a thumbs up 3 minutes ago, so we're good.
Nice. Perfect. So nice. This worked out terrific. I know Steve's got a meeting he's got to run off to. So Steve, where can people find you and Killer Minnow?
You can find me on killerminnow.com or Steve Lettieri on Twitter.
And Zach, how about you?
You can find me at twitter.com/ZachLouis. My name is spelled weird. Don't judge me for it. It's ZACKLUYE.
That's all right. We will, as long as you spell it out, people can find you on the Twitter. People can find me at LONSEIDMAN on Twitter because my name doesn't actually spell like it's pronounced sometimes.
Yeah, we've got weird names, Lon.
We do. I'll tell you what, being a Lon.
Actually, all three of us do.
We really do. And I'll tell you what, though, at having the name Lon Seidman is tough to begin with. Apparently, there's another guy out there who actually has my exact same name. I Googled myself because everyone has to Google themselves.
And right, absolutely.
He's got my name, like right down, middle name and everything. It's crazy. Spelled the same, you name it. But it's always difficult to do that. And one of the greatest things about being on TWIM is that I am meeting more and more people named Lon on Twitter who are coming out. So we're actually starting a support group
Facebook like page.
Exactly. I should start that actually. But you know, I've been called Lon, Don, Ron, Lorne because people aren't used to hearing it, and I've just given up correcting people. So, but you can find me on Twitter, LONSEIDMAN, and also if you are in or near the Connecticut area, and Steve, I hope you can make it up to this. That's what I wanted to come by and talk to you about too. Yep. We're setting up a network of independent producers, video, text, pictures, and otherwise. So if you have some great independent content and you're doing some stuff that's getting even a modest audience, we want to talk to you. So send me a note on Twitter. I know many people have had already, and we'll get you information on a conference that we're putting together on the 29th in Hartford at the University of Hartford, my alma mater. So we definitely want to get more folks out for that. It's a revenue sharing and content sharing thing, so totally free of charge, and there's no obligation, no risk. In fact, we're not even asking for money at any point in this thing. We want to give people money, so that should whet people's appetite. I also want to remind people that facebook.com/pages/thisweekinmedia is the place where you can go to keep up with the show and keep up with us. So definitely find that. And this mess you've been listening to was recorded on January 11th, 2011, 11-1-1-1-1, and we are over and out.
This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jaminkar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.